Widdershins found that he was walking beside Throat's litter. He'd not expected an actual military march, and already his bare feet inside his worn boots were raw. He'd always hated having to throw his heels down with every step, feeling the shocks shooting up his spine, and having to lift his knees higher than usual was wearing him out. He could see the end ahead, the edge of the damned camp. Once out of sight of these wretched regulars going all formal on them, they could relax again. He'd happily forgotten all this shit, those first months of training before he'd managed to slip across into the Marines, where discipline didn't mean striding in cadence and throwing the shoulders back and all that rubbish, where it meant doing your job and not wasting time on anything else. He remembered the first officers he'd encountered, bitching about companies like the Bridgeburners.
Sloppy, slouching slackers. Couldn't get them to stand in a straight line if their lives depended on it, and as likely to slit their officers' throats as take an order.
Well, not quite. If it was a good order, a smart order, they'd step up smart. If it was a stupid order, an order that would see soldiers die for no good reason, well, the choice was not doing it and getting hammered for insubordination or quietly arranging a tragic battlefield casualty. Maybe the Bridgeburners had been the worst of the lot, but they'd also been the best, too. No, Widdershins liked being a Marine, a bone hunter in the tradition of their unruly predecessors. At least it had put an end to this kind of marching. His heels were already bloody in his boots. Dead Smell didn't want to say goodbye, not to anyone. Not even Throat Slitter limping one row ahead of him, whom, with a choice comment or two, he could make yelp that laugh, like squeezing a duck. Always entertaining, seeing people flinch on hearing it, and Dead Smell could do it over and over again. It had been a while since he'd last heard it, but now was not the time. Not with all these regulars on either side. All these men and women saying goodbye to us. The Bone Hunters were in their last days. This tortured army could finally see the end of things, and it seemed to have come up on them fast, unexpected, appallingly close.
But no, we marched across half a world. We chased a whirlwind. We walked out of a burning city. We stood against our own in Malas City. We took down the Lethary Empire, held off the Naruk. We crossed a desert that couldn't be crossed. Now I know how the Bridgeburners must have felt, as the last of them was torn down, crushed underfoot, all that history vanishing, soaking red into the earth. Back home in the Empire, we're already lost. Just one more army struck off the ledgers. And this is how things pass, how things simply go away. We've gone and marched ourselves off the edge of the world. I don't want to say goodbye, and I want to hear Throat Slitter's manic laugh. I want to hear it again and again, and forevermore.
Hedge had drawn up his Bridgeburners just outside the northwest edge of the encampment. Waiting for the Marines and heavies to appear, he scanned his collection of soldiers. They were loaded down, almost groaning beneath the weight of their gear.
Way too many kittens.
Sergeant Rumjugs caught his eye and he nodded. She moved up to position herself at his side as he turned to face the Bone Hunter camp.
Ever seen the like, sir? Who do you think gave the command for that? Maybe the adjunct herself?
Hedge shook his head.
No command, Sergeant. This came from somewhere else. From the regulars themselves, rank and file and all that. I admit it, I didn't think they had this in them.
Sir, we heard rumours about the Marines and heavies that maybe they won't want us with them.
Doesn't matter, Sergeant. When it comes right down to it, we don't even take orders from the adjunct.
But didn't she...
I lied, Hedge said. I ain't talked to nobody. This is my decision.
He glanced over at her.
Got a problem with that, Sergeant?
But she was grinning. Hedge studied her.
You find that funny, do you? Why?
She shrugged.
Sir, we heard rumours, other ones, about us not being real Bridgeburners, but you just proved them wrong, didn't you? We don't belong to nobody, only to each other and to you, sir. You lied! Ha!
Behind them, Sweetlard said,
Last night I took a man to bed for free, sir, and you know why? When he asked me how old I was, and I said 26, he believed me. Lies are sweet, ain't they?
Here they come, said Hedge.
Fiddler had appeared, leading his troops out from the camp. Even from this distance, Hedge could see the faces of the Marines and heavies, sickly, grim. They'd not been expecting any sort of send-off.
And they don't know what to do with it. Did Fiddler throw a salute back? No, he wouldn't have. Fid, I see you. You're as bad off as the rest of them, like you're headed for the executioner. Us soldiers only got one kind of coin worth anything, and it's called respect. And we hoard it, we hide it away, and there ain't nobody who'd call us generous. Easy spenders were not. But there's something feels even worse than having to give up a coin. It's when somebody steps up and tosses one back at us. We get antsy, we look away, and part of us feels like breaking inside. And we get down on ourselves, and outsiders don't understand that. They think we should smile and wave or stand proud. But we don't want to do anything of the sort, even when we're made to. It's because of all the friends we left behind on all those battlefields, because we know that they're the ones deserving of all that respect. We could sit on a king's hoard of those coins and still stay blind to all of them. Because some riches stick in the throat and choke us going down.
When he saw Fiddler look up and see him, Hedge strode over.
Don't do this, Fid.
Do what?
I told you, not that. You halt your company now. You form them up facing those regulars. You're captain now, and they're looking to you. It's the coin, Fiddler. You got to give it back.
The captain stared at Hedge for a long moment.
Didn't think it'd be this hard.
So you thought to just run away?
Fiddler shook his head.
No, I didn't know what to do. Wasn't sure what they wanted.
Cocking his head, Hedge said,
You're not convinced they're worth it, are you?
The captain was silent. Hedge shook his head.
We ain't made for this, you and me, Fid. We're sappers. When I get in trouble on all this stuff, I just think, what would Whiskey Jack do? Listen, you need those regulars to stand up. You need them to buy you the time needed. You need them to buy it with their own blood, their own lives. It don't matter if you think they've not earned a damn thing. You got to give the coin back.
When Fiddler still hesitated, Hedge swung round and gestured to his bridge burners, then turned back.
We're forming up, Fid, faces to the camp. You just gonna stand there with all your marines and heavies mobbing up and not knowing where to fucking look? No,
Fiddler replied in a thick voice.
Hedge, I think I just faltered a step, that's all. Better now than a few days from now, eh?
As Hedge moved to join his squads, Fiddler called out,
Wait!
He turned back.
What now?
Something else everyone needs to see, I think.
And Fiddler stepped forward and held out his hand. Hedge eyed it.
You think that's enough? Start there, idiot.
Smiling, Hedge grasped that forearm, and Fiddler pulled him into a hard embrace. Badal stood atop a wagon, Sadik at her side, watching the scene at the edge of camp.
What's happening, Badal?
Sadik asked.
Wounds take time to heal,
she replied, watching the two men embracing, feeling a vast tension seem to drain away on all sides.
Are they lovers? Brothers,
she said.
The one with the red beard. You called him father, Badal. Why? It's what being a soldier is all about. That is what I have seen since we found them. You do not choose your family, and sometimes there's trouble in that family, but you don't choose. But they did. They chose to be soldiers. And then they come face to face with death, Sadik. That is the blood tie, and it makes a knot not even dying can cut. And that is why the others are saluting. Soon, she said, very soon, we are going to see this family awaken to anger. But Mother is sending those ones away. Will we ever see them again? It's easy, Sedic, she said. Just close your eyes.
Walking slowly, Pors made his way to the edge of the camp so that he could look out on the marines and heavies, who were now forming up to face the regulars. He looked round for the adjunct, but could not see her, nor was Fist Blistig anywhere in sight. The man who tried to murder me. There is nothing more dangerous than a man without a sense of humour. As Fiddler and Hedge drew apart and headed for their respective companies, Faradan Sort came up alongside Pors, and then, on his other side, Fist Kindly. Pors sighed. Fists, was all this by your command?
I was barking orders when they just stood up and left me standing there, said Faradan Sort. They're as bad as marines, these regulars.
We will see if that's true soon enough, Kindly said. Master Sergeant Lieutenant Pors, are you recovered? Some additional healing proved possible once we were away from the desert. As you see, sir, I'm up and about. It is your innate laziness that still needs addressing.
Yes, sir.
Are you agreeing with me, Master Sergeant Lieutenant Pors? I always agree with you, sir.
Oh, enough, you two, Faradan Sort said. We're about to be saluted.
All the regulars had drawn to this side of the camp and stood in an uneven mass. There was an ease to all of this that Pors found peculiar, as if the entire structure of the military, in all its rigidity and inane affectation, had ceased to be relevant. The regulars no longer held their own salute and now stood watching, for all the world like a crowd drawn down to the docks to see a fleet's departure from the bay, while Captain Fiddler moved out to stand in front of his marines, facing them all. He lifted his hand in a salute, held it for a moment, as his soldiers did the same, and then let the hand fall. And that was it. No answering gesture from the regulars. Pors grunted.
It's the old coin thing, isn't it?
Indeed, replied Kindly in a rough voice.
He cleared his throat and said,
That tradition was born on the Seti Plain from the endless internecine warfare among the horse clans. Honest scraps ended in an exchange of trophy coins.
He was silent for a few breaths, and then he sighed.
Seti combs are works of art, antler and horn polished to a luster. I feel another bout of laziness coming on, sir. Isn't it time you ordered me to do something?
Blinking, Kindly faced Pors, then shocked him with a hand on his shoulder.
Not today.
And he walked back into camp. Faradan Sort remained at his side for a moment longer.
If he had a son to choose, Pors...
I've already been disowned once, Fist, and regardless of what you might think, I'm not a glutton for punishment.
She studied him.
He was saying goodbye.
I know what it was,
Pors snapped, wincing as he turned too quickly away. When she reached to take his arm, he waved her off. Both gestures made his chest hurt, but that was the kind of pain he welcomed these days, keeping the other kind at bay.
Forgot to thank him. Dead smell. And now it's too late. And now Kindly goes all soft on me. Where's the fun in that?
Go back to your wagon, Faradan Sort said. I'll detail 3 squads for the harness.
No heavies now. Better make it 4, Fist.
It is my understanding, she replied, that we do not have far to go today.
Despite himself, he glanced over at her.
Really? Has she announced our destination then?
She has.
And?
She looked across at him.
We're looking for a suitable field of battle.
Pors thought about that for a few moments.
So they know we're here?
Yes, Lieutenant. And they are marching to meet us.
He looked to the departing column of marines and heavies.
Then, where are they going? This is what I get for lying half dead for days, and then spoon-feeding old Shorthand, waiting for a word from him. Just one word, something more than just staring into space. That's not a proper way for a man to end his days. And now I don't know what the hood's going on. Me, of all people.
The camp was breaking up behind him. Everything coming down for the march was barely a single word spoken. He'd never known an army as quiet as this one.
Fist?
Yes.
Will they fight?
She stepped close, her eyes cold as ice. You don't ask that kind of question, Porus. Not another word. Am I understood?
I fist? I just don't want to be the only one unsheathing my sword, that's all.
You're in no condition for that.
That detail hardly matters, Fist.
Making a face, she turned away. I suppose not. Porus watched her head back into the camp.
Besides, I might need that sword. If Blistig gets close, it's not like he'll be of any use in the scrap. The very opposite, in fact. But I'll choose the perfect moment. It's all down to timing. All of life is down to timing. And that was always my talent, wasn't it? I'm mostly a nice guy. Made a career of avoiding blood and fighting and all the unpleasant stuff. The challenge was pulling that off while being in an army. But not as hard as it sounds. No matter. It's not as if I'm afraid of war. It's the chaos I don't like. Kindly's combs. Now, you see, those I do understand. That man I understand, through and through, and being his one unruly comb, why, how perfect was that? Mostly a nice guy, like I said, but Blistig tried killing me for a few empty casks. I don't feel like being nice anymore.
Adjunct wishes to see you, Fist, said Lostara Yil.
Blistig glanced up, saw the look in her eyes and decided to ignore it. Grunting, he straightened from where he had been sitting amidst discarded equipment. He followed the woman through the camp, paying little attention to the preparations going on around them. These regulars were good at going through all the motions. They'd done enough of it, after all, and had probably walked more leagues since forming up than most people did in a lifetime. But that didn't add any notches on the scabbard, did it? For all their professionalism, suddenly rediscovered since the blood for water miracle, and not just rediscovered but reinvented with a discipline so zealous it bordered on the obsessive, these regulars looked fragile to Blistig. They would melt away before the enemy at the first hint of pressure. He'd seen them lining the route taken by the marines and heavies. He'd seen their pathetic salutes. Good for gestures now, these soldiers, but their faces were empty. They had the look of the dead. Every man, every woman. When Lostara reached the entrance to the adjunct's tent, she halted, gesturing him inside. He moved past her, stepped within. Only the front chamber remained standing. The back end of the tent was already unstaked and hanging in a thick, creased wall behind Tavare, who stood facing him. There was no one else present, not even that smirking priest, and Lostara Yil had not followed him in.
What is it, adjunct? I have troops to oversee if you want us up and on the way before noon.
Fist Blistig, I am placing you in command of the center. You will have Fist Kindly on your right and Fist Faradan Sort on your left. Warleader Gaul will hold the Cundrill in reserve, along with the skirmishers and archers. He stared at her, dumbfounded.
You are describing the presentation for battle, he said. But there won't be any battle. It will be a rout. We will face Forkrell Asael, and you've gone and given up your sword. Their sorcery will overwhelm us.
Her eyes held on his, unwavering. You will hold the center, Fist. That is your only task in the upcoming engagement. You will be attacked by normal soldiers, Colansi, a conventional army. Expect them to be highly disciplined and well-trained. If there are heavy infantry among the enemy, then you can be certain that they will strike for your position. You will not yield a single step, is that understood? Blistig drew off his helmet, contemplated throwing it at the woman standing opposite him. Instead, he clawed a hand through his thinning hair.
I could kill her right now here in this tent. But she bought their souls again, didn't she? I'd never get away alive. Better to wait, find a more perfect moment. But then who am I trying to fool? Put me there, adjunct, and I'll take a knife to the back before the Colansi even crest the horizon.
There was a look in her eyes that made him wonder if she'd seen right through to his thoughts, if she knew how close she was to being murdered and simply did not care enough to feel fear. Fist, I was advised when in Arran to leave you in command of the city garrison. Indeed, there was talk of promoting you to the city's fist. And had that occurred, it is possible that you would then be touted to become High Fist, overseeing all of South Seven Cities. I understand that what I have just described would have suited you perfectly, at least until the next uprising. Blistig's voice was a rasp.
What is the point of this, adjunct?
However, your proponents, the officers and functionaries in Arran, couldn't see a span beyond their city's walls. They could not imagine that Jistal Malik Rel would not rot away the rest of his days in a jail cell or lose his head to a pike above the main gate. In other words, they had no comprehension of the extent of the man's influence, how it had already corrupted the Claw, or that his agents were even then positioned within reach of Lassine's throne. Furthermore, she continued, still studying him, that his hatred for you and your betrayal at Arran following Coltane's fall pretty much assured your eventual assassination. You may indeed be unaware that between the fall and my arrival in the city, three attempts were made on your life, all of them successfully intercepted, at the cost of four valuable agents. Your transfer to under my command was in fact the only means of keeping you alive, Fist Blistig. The fourth time your life was saved was at Malaz City. Had we failed in extricating ourselves, you would have been arrested and executed. Now, you may choose to believe that I undertook such efforts because I value you as a commander, and be sure that to this day I remain impressed and admiring of your quick wit and decisiveness when refusing to yield Arran to the rebels. But that was not my primary reason for saving your life. Malik Rel, High Fist Corbalo Dom and their interests would seek to revise the events at Arran. The outlawing and castigation of the Wiccans was but the beginning. Fist Blistig, there are few who know the truth of those events. I saved your life to keep that truth alive. He was silent following this speech. A part of him wanted to disbelieve every word, wanted to call her a damned liar and a self-serving one at that, but how could any of this be self-serving? She was placing him in command of the center, probably facing heavy infantry, among Malazan soldiers who despised him. She'd saved his life only to throw it away now, and how did that make sense, any sense at all?
Adjunct, are you expecting me to thank you?
The only expectation of any importance, Fist, concerns commanding the center to the best of your abilities.
They won't follow me.
They will.
Why should they?
Because they will have no one else.
No one. Where will you be, adjunct?
I will be facing the Fokral Asael and their sorcery. I will be fighting the power of their will. I will be preventing it from reaching my soldiers.
But you gave up your damned sword, woman.
There are residual effects to bearing such a weapon, Fist. In any case, none of that is your concern.
Except when you fail, when you fall.
Even then, Fist. His eyes narrowed on her.
That only works if you take them down with you. Is that the plan, adjunct? One final sacrifice to defend an army that doesn't even like you, that doesn't want to be here, that doesn't even know what it's supposed to be fighting for? And then you expect me and the other fists to hold them together, with you dead and gone?
She cocked her head. You are contradicting yourself. He waved a dismissive hand, the gesture chopping the air. Tavaray seemed to flinch slightly at that, but the tone of her next words belied the impression. Maintain your line with the flanks, Fist.
We're going to get cut to pieces.
Turning away, she reached for her leather gloves. If so, Fist, just make sure you take a long time dying. He left without bothering to salute, walked with his helm dangling from one hand.
Three foiled attempts on my life? A corrupted Claw? Then who did the foiling?
Banaskar stood 20 paces away from her tent, motionless while figures moved in measured haste around him, wanting to be a heavy stone in the stream, a place to set a foot and find an instant or two of rest. But his was a lifeless island until Lostara Yil found him, taking his arm in hers and pulling him round. Hanar Vigolf grinning off to one side.
What is this?
Banaskar demanded, only vaguely resisting as she led him away. He'd just seen Blistig exit Tavare's tent, his stride echoing that of a lifeless Talani Mas, and he'd been considering going to the adjunct again to see what he could glean of what had taken place between her and the fist. Instead, he was being pulled away. And there, ahead, stood a small group of officers, Scannero, Ruthan Gud, Raband, and Faradan Sort. Banaskar sought to disengage his arm.
You keep forgetting I'm not actually in this army.
Our last palaver, said Lostara. Make it mocking, make it solemn, however you like it, priest, but it will happen, and you will be in attendance.
Why?
They'd reached the others, and Banaskar saw the expectation in their faces and wanted to hide under a shield. Ruthan Gud, fingers combing his beard, was the first to speak.
Priest, we've all been given our orders. Will you be at the adjunct's side through all of this?
All of what? The dying? I don't know. I doubt it.
Why?
Asked Faradan Sort, the word sharp, accusing. He shrugged.
I expect she will be fighting, eventually.
Lostara Yil cleared her throat in the silence that followed and then said,
She has ordered me, Hanar and Ruthan Gud, to attend to her at all times.
That makes sense, Banaskar said.
It's the Forkrel Asael, isn't it?
To Lostara's question, Banaskar simply shrugged again.
She has surrendered her sword somewhere, said Faradan Sort. How does she expect to defend herself against the sorcery of the Asael?
I don't know.
Raband voiced a raw curse and looked ready to leave, but Scannero shook her head at him and he subsided, scowling. Lostara caught Banaskar's eye. He could see fear in hers.
Priest, I do not think I will again shadow dance. Not the way I did before. If she is expecting such a thing from me, perhaps against the Forkrel Asael.
Captain, I don't know what she is expecting, said Banaskar quietly. You and Ruthan Gud, you have both shown exceptional abilities. Is that why she wants you close? I imagine that it is. And at the moment of greatest need, will she look to you too? Why wouldn't she?
I can't do it again.
Banaskar glanced over at Ruthan Gud.
And what of you, Captain? Besieged by the same uncertainties, are you? Or will the gift of the Storm Riders reawaken to protect you?
The adjunct clearly believes that it will, he replied.
Have you told her otherwise, Captain?
It's complicated.
Is it not why you're here? Banaskar asked. Was this not the reason for their gift?
The others were studying Ruthan Gud now, and the man looked decidedly unhappy.
It depends. Nobody's ever as forthcoming on these things as one might like. Did they know what was hidden in Kolanz? Probably. Are they interested in liberation?
Hardly,
growled Faradan Sort, one hand now on the sword belted at her side. Ruthan Gud's eyes flicked down to that weapon, and his smile was wry when he lifted his gaze to Faradan's.
I suspected you had a sound reason for forswearing the wall.
I fought 3 links from Greymane.
Ruthan Gud nodded but said nothing more. Breath hissed from Lostara Yil.
This isn't fair. Ruthan, do you fear using what the Stormriders gave you?
The Stormriders are not a people given to compromise,
Banaskar said, when it was clear that Ruthan Gud had no intention of replying.
The captain senses the ambivalence in what is to come, and the risk of failure. He anticipates that the power of the Storm Riders will, if unleashed, conclude that said risk is too great, with too much to lose should the adjunct's plan fail.
Lostara said,
Ruthan, do you not control that power?
Finally, the man scowled and said,
Ask that of yourself and the Shadow Dance, Lostara Yil.
But that is the will of a god.
And whom do the Stormriders serve? Does anyone even know? You, Faradan? Are they mindless, senseless creatures? You have stood the wall. Tell her. Tell her what you have seen with your own eyes.
They have purpose, she said slowly. They are driven. More than that, I cannot say. This is getting us nowhere, said Raband. The fact is this, you and me, Scannero, we're in command of our companies. Is there anything more that you and I need know? Then I suggest we head back to our troops and leave the rest of their discussion to our superiors.
Banaskar watched him dragging Scannero away by one arm. She threw a look back at Ruth and Gud, but he either did not notice or chose not to, and so did not see the crushing grief take her face. Sighing, Faradan Sort drew her gauntlets from her belt.
Fare you well, captains.
The priest looked up at the morning sky, squinted at the jade strangers.
Never been closer. We only have a day or two. Not more, surely.
Cotillion swore to me that he would never again take possession, said Lostari Yil.
Banaskar shot her a searching look.
Too tempting, I imagine.
What's given and what's taken away, priest?
He nodded, understanding her meaning.
I was expecting to survive all of this, said Ruthengard. Now I am not so sure.
So you know how the rest of us feel, snapped Lostari Yil.
But the man simply turned to Banaskar.
If you will not be with her, priest, then where will you be? What is your reason for being here?
There is a question that has been haunting me,
he replied over the sound of the first horns announcing column formation.
How does a mortal win over a god? Has it ever happened before, even? Has the old order been overturned? Or is this just special circumstance? A moment unique in all of history?
You have won the Worm of Autumn to her cause, priest?
At Lostara's question, Banaskar frowned. He studied her for a moment and then glanced at Ruthengard.
You look shocked, he said to him. Is it that I somehow possessed that power? Or is it the very idea that what we do in this mortal world, with our lives, with our will, could make a god kneel before us?
Then he shook his head.
But you both misunderstood me. I was not speaking of myself at all. I cannot win over a god, even when I am the last priest in that god's house. Don't you understand? It's her. She did it. Not me.
She spoke to your god?
Banaskar grunted.
No, Lostara. She rarely speaks at all. You of all people should know that by now. No. Instead, she simply refused to waver from her path, and by that alone she has humbled the gods. Do you understand me? Humbled them.
Ruthengard shook his head.
The gods are too arrogant to ever be humbled.
A year ago, lying drunk on my cot, I would have agreed with you, Captain. So tell me now, will you fight for her?
His eyes were thinned as he studied Banaskar, and then he said,
with all my heart.
The gasp that came from Lostara was almost a sob. The bone hunters formed up into column. Alone by express order, the adjunct mounted her horse and remained motionless on it until the last of the wagons they were taking trundled past, and then she took up her reins and swung the animal to face west. She could see the worn path taken by the marines and the heavies, angling slightly northward but still on a westerly track. They were already out of sight, vanishing into the deceptive folds of the plain. Her hand brushed the empty scabbard at her side, and then away again. She adjusted the strap of her helm and looked down to examine her worn, oft-mended Malazan uniform. The burgundy was faded, the grey worn to white in places. The leather of her gloves was cracked, sweat and salt-stained. The armour bands protecting her thighs had rubbed through the underpadding here and there. She had clasped her cloak to the fittings situated on the harness over her breastbone, and the black wool hung heavy, drawing her shoulders back. Adjusting its weight until it was even, she straightened and ran a hand across the fittings she could reach, tightening them where needed. reached up and pushed stray wisps of thin hair from her cheeks. Guiding her horse round, she nudged the animal into a slow trot. As she passed her soldiers on her left, the adjunct held her gaze straight ahead. Faces turned to watch her. No one called out, not a word of encouragement, not a single jest, not a question rising up above the thump of boots and the rustle of gear to which she might respond with a word or two. She held herself straight, moving slowly, making her way towards the head of the column. And of all the journeys she had undertaken since the very beginning, this one, from the back of the column to its head, was the longest one she had ever travelled, and, as ever, she travelled it alone. Riding bone-white jag horses, the three Forkrell Asael reined in a third of a league ahead of their armies. In their minds they could hear distant clamour, and they knew that the assault against the great spire had begun. But Akrast Cor Verlaine was trembling with blows from foreign magics, both ancient and new, and so details evaded their questing. The unease drifting between them was, alas, palpable.
"It does not matter," Brother Aloft announced. "We have before us a singular task, and in this we shall prevail. If it follows that we must retrace our steps to win once more the altar of judgment, then we shall do so."
Sister Freedom spoke.
"Brothers, I sense three threats before us, but one will not reach us in time to effect the forthcoming battle, so we can, for the moment, discount it. It is, however, the smaller of the two elements before us that troubles me. Clearly, they have a specific intention, and the main force marching towards us is positioning itself with the aim of blocking our advance. From this, I conclude that the purpose of the smaller force is of vital importance."
Brother Aloft slowly nodded.
"What do you propose, sister?"
"We each possess an army, brothers, if my senses are accurate, and I assure you that they are. Any one of us alone is more than a match for the main force ahead of us. However, bearing in mind that our enemy is perhaps formidable in ways we have not yet been made aware of, they did manage to cross the glass desert, after all, I advise that we commit two armies to their destruction. The third, perhaps yours, Brother Grave, sets off at a faster pace to hunt down the smaller force and prevent them from doing whatever it is they plan to do."
"And this small force," Brother Grave said in his thin voice, "they flee northwest, yes?"
"I doubt it is flight as such, brother," Freedom said, frowning. "I continue to sense a measure of confidence in you, Brother Grave, perhaps somewhat overinflated under the circumstances."
The older peer snorted.
"We shall face humans. Thus far, in all my thousands of years of life, I have yet to be impressed by these creatures. Nevertheless, I implore you to engage with surety tempered by caution, brother." "I shall be suitably exact in the execution of my mission, Sister Freedom. I shall hunt down this handful of humans and destroy them."
"Your words reassure me," she replied. "Brother Aloft, I welcome your advice in the matter to follow, as much as I do Brother Graves. That third element, so disturbingly efficacious against our northern forces, is, as I said, too far away to affect the engagements we anticipate. However, there is the slight risk, as it is known that certain companies among them are mounted, that they would in fact intercept Brother Grave should he lead his forces north from here in his effort to reach his target as quickly as possible. You see, my instincts are that Brother Grave's foe, despite its paltry size, is in fact the most dangerous element now arrayed before us."
"Understood, Sister Freedom. Then might I suggest the following, that Brother Grave divide his army on the basis of speed of travel, that he personally lead his light and medium infantry not northwestward, but southwest, skirting the force you and I shall engage, and then striking due north behind said enemy, while in turn his heavy infantry take the shorter northwest route,
Being heavy infantry, they can well successfully withstand incursions by cavalry should the unexpected happen. If led by the purest of the watered, the heavy infantry element can coordinate their arrival at the target to coincide with Brother Graves' own companies, as rudimentary communication should be possible. Sister Freedom turned to Brother Grave.
Does this suit you, brother? Light and medium elements constitute a little over 2,000 soldiers. My force was ever weighted on the heavier elements, organized as it originally was for sieges and set battles. Sister Freedom, how accurate is your gauging of the complement of this smaller enemy force? No more than 100, I believe, Brother Grave. Well, then, the man smiled, face folding with the expression. 2,000 against 100. Will you both forgive me for a small measure of confidence regarding those odds?
Brother Aloft said, Since we are certain that there is nothing like a pass or any other similar feature into which to force attackers, then I cannot but share your confidence, Brother Grave. At best, the enemy will be defending a hill, perhaps one of the ancient Elan barrow camps, and so can be attacked from all sides. And of course, even should the light and medium forces fail, the heavy infantry companies will rejoin you and thereby contribute to subsequent assaults. Given all this, I believe we have successfully addressed the matter of the smaller enemy force. Aloft faced Freedom. Only 100, you say? Perhaps they are deserters.
It is possible, she conceded, yet my instincts say otherwise.
With vehemence? She glanced at him.
Yes, Brother Aloft, with vehemence.
Then, if I may, said Aloft, we should perhaps discuss another concern. The third force, which has so thoroughly negated our efforts at defeating or even containing it, is now marching with the clear intention of joining this battle. Though, as you say, sister, they will be too late. My thoughts are these. It is too great a reach to imagine that there has been no coordination here. To begin, the strongest fortress in Estobance is taken, thus threatening our north and, more important, our primary source of food, being the Valley Province. We respond by sending armies against them, only to have them crushed. Now, from what we are able to glean from Sister Reverence and Brother Diligence at the Spire, two distinct elements have engaged us from the south. And we, of course, now march to block an incursion from the west. For all we know, a foreign fleet is even now entering Colan's Bay. He surveyed the expressions before him and slowly nodded. This was well planned, do you not agree? Its principal aim, to draw apart our active armies, has already succeeded. In each instance, we are forced to react rather than initiate.
A proficient high command, then, said Sister Freedom, nodding.
But Aloft shook his head. In truth, this has the feel of a grand strategy, and just as your instincts speak with vehemence to you about the matter of the smaller force, Sister Freedom, so now my instincts have been shouting that this invasion, this strategy, and each and every tactical engagement is in fact the product of a single individual's will. He nodded to Brother Grave. I accept your assessment of humans in general, but is it not also true that on rare occasions there rises from the multitude of mediocrity that is humanity a single person of extraordinary vision, conjoined with the will to achieve that vision, who presents a most formidable presence, one to shape the course of history? Brother Grave grunted.
Charismatic tyrants, you mean? Indeed, they do appear from time to time, burning bright and deadly and expunged just as quickly. Such individuals among humans are inevitably self-corrupting, and for all that they may shape history, that shaping is more often than not simply born out of that tyrant's indulgence in destruction. Brother Aloft, you may well be right that we face such a person behind all of this, but does it matter in the end? And is it not that unbridled ambition that assures the fool's demise? I would venture, with considerable amusement, that we now represent that fatal overreaching on that tyrant's part.
He faced Sister Freedom.
Have you not confirmed that the northern threat is too far away? This grand execution of coordinated invasions has failed, in fact.
It may be as you say, acknowledged Brother Aloft. But what if our eyes deceive us? What if what we are seeing is in fact precisely what our opponent wants us to see?
Now you are too generous by far, Sister Freedom admonished him. This is a breakdown in timing, perhaps precipitated by our detecting this western threat almost the instant it stepped out from the glass desert, and already being in perfect position to strike them with little delay.
I accept the wisdom of your words, sister.
I will not castigate you, brother, for listening to your instincts, although, as we all know, if left unrestrained, instincts have a way of encouraging panic, as they lie beyond the control of the intellect to begin with, theirs is the shorter path to fear.
The three Forkrell Asael were silent then, each preoccupied with their own thoughts. And then Sister Freedom said,
I shall seek to enslave the soldiers we face. They could prove useful.
But not the 100 I hunt, said Brother Grave.
No, she agreed. Kill them all, brother.
Ben Adifon Delat reined in hard, his horse's hoofs skidding through the parched grasses. Cursing, Calam wheeled his mount round, the beast pitching beneath him in its exhaustion. He glared back at his friend. What is it now, quick? But the wizard held up a hand, shaking his head. Settling back to ease his aching spine, Calam looked round, seeing nothing but empty rolling land. The taint of green from the jade slashes overhead made the world look sickly, but already he was growing used to that.
Never mind the adjunct,
Quick Ben said. Calam shot him a startled look.
What? Her brother? I know. You think this was easy? I felt them pulling apart. I've been thinking about that all morning. I know why Ganos wants us to find her. I know why he sent us ahead, but it's no good, Calam. I'm sorry, it's no good.
The assassin stared at his friend for a moment longer, and then he sagged, spat to clear the taste of ashes from his mouth.
She's on her own, then. Aye, her choice.
No, don't even try that, Quick. This is your choice.
She's forced my hand, damn you.
How? What has she done? What's all this about pulling apart? What in Hood's name does that even mean?
Quick Ben's horse must have picked up some of its rider's agitation, for it now shied beneath him, and he fought to regain control for a moment. As the animal backed in a half circle, the wizard swore under his breath.
Listen, it's not with her anymore. She's made herself the sacrifice. How do you think I can even know this? Calam, she's given up her sword.
Calam stared.
What? But I can feel it, that weapon. It's the blank place in my vision. That's where we have to go.
So she dies, does she? Just like that?
Quick Ben rubbed at his face.
No, we've been doing too much of this, all of us, from the very start. Back to the fucking riddles. Underestimating her. From damned near the first day I ended up with the Bone Hunters, I've listened to us all second-guessing her every damned step she took. I did my share, who knows. But it wasn't just me, was it? Her officers, the Marines, the fucking camp cook. What did you tell me a while back about that moment in Mock's Hold when she asked you to save her? You did it, you said, because she just asked you. No bargaining, no reasons or explanations. She just went and asked you, Calam. Was it hard saying yes? Tell me the truth, was it?
Slowly, Calam shook his head. But I sometimes wondered, did I just feel sorry for her?
Quick Ben reacted as if he'd been slapped. In a soft voice, he asked, "Do you still think that, Callum?" The assassin was silent, thinking about it. Then he sighed. "We know where Ganos wants us. We even know why. He's her brother, for Hood's sake. We know where she wants us too, Callum. Do we?" Quick Ben slowly nodded. "So which of the fucking Parans do we obey here? Which one would you rather face? Here or other side of the gates, to tell him you failed, that you made the wrong choice? No, I don't mean brazening it out either. Just standing there, saying what needs saying." "Fuck. I feel like I'm back in Mok's hold," he said in a growl. "I feel as if I never left." "And she meets your eyes." Abruptly, a sob took the assassin, vicious as a body blow and just as unexpected. His friend waited, saying nothing, and Callum knew that he wouldn't, because they'd been through it all together. Because true friends knew when to keep silent, to give all the patience needed. Callum struggled to lock down on his emotions. He wasn't even sure what had taken him in that moment. "Maybe this unrelenting pressure, this endless howl no one else even hears. I stood looking down on the city. I stood knowing I was about to walk a path of blood. The betrayal didn't even matter, not to me. The claw was always full of shits. Did it matter to her either? No. She'd already dismissed it. Just one more knife in her chest. And she was already carrying plenty of those, starting with the one she stuck there with her own hands." Callum shook himself. "Same direction?" "For now," Quick Ben replied, "until we get closer, then southwest." "To the sword?" "To the sword. Anyone babysitting it, Quick?" "I hope not." Callum gathered his reins, drew a deep breath, and slowly eased it back out. "Quick, how did she manage to cross that desert anyway?" The wizard shook his head, half smiled. "Guess we underestimated her." After a moment, they set out once again. Wings crooking, Silchas Rowan slid earthward. After a moment, Tulas Shorn followed. To the south, they could see something like a cloud or a swarm. The air hissing past their wings felt brittle, fraught with distant pain, rolling like waves across the sky. Silchas Rowan landed hard on the ground, stumbled almost immediately, and staggered forward, hands held over his ears. Taking his Edor form, Tulas Shorn studied his friend, but drew no closer. Overhead, one of the jade slashes began edging across the face of the sun. A sudden deepening of shadow enveloped them, the gloom eerie and turgid. Groaning, Silchas finally straightened, stiff as an old man. He looked across.
"It's the Hust sword," he said. "Its howling was driving me mad."
"I hear nothing," Tulas said.
"In my skull, I swear I could feel bones crack."
"Unsheath it, friend."
Silchas Rowan looked over with wide eyes, his expression filling with dread.
"Grasp it when you veer."
"And what will that achieve?"
"I don't know. But I cannot imagine that this gift was meant to torture you. Your only other choice, Silchas, is to discard it."
He gestured southward.
"We are almost upon them. I am frankly astonished that she still lives. But if we delay here much longer..."
"Tulas, I am afraid."
"Of dying? A little late for that."
Silchas smiled, but it was more of a grimace.
"Easy for you to say."
"I dwelt a long time in the House of Death, tormented by the truth that I failed to achieve what I most wanted in my life. That sense of terrible incompleteness overwhelmed me many times. But now I stand with you, my brother, and I will fall in your stead if I can in this battle to come. Oblivion does not frighten me. I see only its blessed release.
Siltras Ruin studied him. Then he sighed and reached for the sword. Hand closing on its plain grip, he slid the weapon free. The husked sword bucked in his hand, voicing a deafening shriek. Tulas Shorn was driven back a step, and he stared in shock as enormous ghostly chains appeared, writhing from the sword's patterned blade. Those chains seemed to be anchored deep into the ground, and suddenly the land beneath them was shaking, pitching them about as if the world was rolling its shoulders. From below, a rising thunder. A blast of dirt and stone lifted skyward off to Tulas Shorn's left, and he bellowed in shock upon seeing a dragon clawing its way free of the steaming earth. And then, off to the right, another erupted in a shower of debris, and then a third, each one chained as it rose from the ground, wings hammering the dust-filled air. Their roars of release ripped across the plain. Siltras Ruin stood, both hands now on the sword, as the ethereal chains snapped taut, scissoring wildly above him like the strands of a wind-whipped thread.
Eloth, Ampelas, Kals!
Tulas Shorn staggered forward.
There, Siltras Ruin, there! We have our storm! He has given us our storm!
Screaming, Siltras Ruin blurred, pungent clouds roiling out from him. Sword and chains vanished, yet the three dragons held close in the air above them. Veering, Tulas Shorn launched himself into the sky. Eloth's voice filled his skull.
Brothers, it is as Cotillion promised. We are freed once more.
Only to die,
cried another voice, Ampelas. Yet there was nothing of frustration in its tone.
Should we prevail, Siltras Ruin, will you vow to break our chains?
And Siltras replied,
Eloth, I so swear.
Then we have a cause worth fighting for. He bargained true. He is a god with honor.
The five ancient dragons wheeled then, climbing ever higher as they winged southward. The shadow cast down by one talon slash in the heavens above them marked their path, true as an arrow into the heart of the battle.
My leg!
Telerast shrieked.
Colonel, I am crippled! Help me!
The other skeletal lizard halted so quickly it fell over, rolled once, twice, and then leapt back to its feet.
Aye! See the shadow? It hunts us! It chases us! Webs across the sky! Telerast, you are doomed. I see a laint. They are coming for us. This was a trap, a lie, a deceit, betrayal, bad luck. Help me, Curdle.
Curdle leapt up and down as if eating flies on the wing.
They only pretended, those two usurpers. They are venal and vicious, selfish. Not Apsalar was their servant, was she not? She was. This has been planned from the very start. Telerast, I will weep for you, my sister, my lover, my occasional acquaintance. I promise I will weep for you. You lying bitch, carry me, save me. I would save you in your place if I was you and you were me, and I wanted to run because that's the smart thing to do, except when I'm me and you're you. Then it's not smart at all.
She clawed furiously at the ground, one leg kicking, trying to reach Curdle, her small hands clutching the air, her serrated jaws clacking in a manic frenzy.
Come closer, I beg you! Snap, snap, snap. I only want to say goodbye, I swear it!
Snap, snap, snap.
The shadow!
Curdle shrieked.
I've waited too long, help!
She began running, leaping over tufts of dead grass, dodging boulders and small stones. Her rush startled a grasshopper into the air, and she bit it in half in passing.
Did you see that? Tell her!
Both creatures veered. Chains cracked like lightning, lifting them skyward.
Storm! Five ancients, now seven!
Eloth greets you, betrayers! Telerast Anthras! Kerudas Carosius!
Eloth! Ampelas! Kals! They still hate us! Telerast, look what you've done!
Carabas, the Otataral dragon, was being driven earthward as dragon after dragon crashed down on her from above, their talons raking through her hide, flensing her wings. She had killed hundreds, but now, at last, she was failing. The land beneath her loomed, every detail a bitter language of death. She could no longer give voice to her fury, her crushing frustration, and was too exhausted to strike out at the Elaint harrying her on all sides. Blood streamed down her flanks, rained like acid on the lifeless earth below. The summons dragged her forward, but she was blind to its purpose. Perhaps nothing more than a lure. Yet the imperative was absolute, and she would strive to answer it. With her last breath, she would seek that fated place.
A trap or a promise? An answer to my prayers or the making of my barrow? No matter. I fail. I would even welcome chains, but they will not grant me that mercy. I feel Mother awakening. I feel Tiam so close now. The storms gathered, the power building. She is coming. She will see me killed.
She pitched as yet another Elaint slammed down on her. With one last surge, she swung her neck round, lacerated jaws stretching wide, and saw seven dragons descending from high above the swarm surrounding her. Another storm.
This ends it, then.
The creature clinging to her back tore itself away, flinching from her jaws. She caught a hind limb, ripped the flesh from the bone. The seven ancients plunged into the maelstrom, and suddenly Elaint was screaming in shock and pain, bodies twisting as they plummeted, blooms of blood like clouds.
They fight to save me, but why? Do not draw near, friends. I am poison. But more, do not die for me. I, whose touch is death, beg you, do not die for me.
Yet on they fought, but now their foes were recovering, and scores lifted higher to close on them.
And should Tiam manifest, she will take even you.
East, the place of the summons, called to her. Torn fragments of meat falling from her jaws, Carabas fixed her gaze upon that beckoning horizon. Her allies had drawn away her assailants, won her a reprieve with fatal sacrifice. She did not understand, but she would honor them in the only possible manner available to her.
If this be a destiny offered me, I shall meet it. I shall face it, and if I can, I shall speak to the world. And if this be the place of my death, so be it. I was free, even if only for a moment. I was free.
He had pushed them hard, marching them through half the night and without pause through most of this day, and the marines and heavies were staggering as they came within sight of the hill. The muscles of his legs leaden, Fiddler angled towards it. Vast bands of shadow were still tracking the landscape, cast down by the jade strangers spanning the entire sky, leaving the captain with a sense that the world was unravelling before his very eyes. He had worked hard not to think about the army they had left behind, and the fate that awaited them. Before the captain, now was all that mattered. That forlorn hilltop with its fractured flanks, the lone sword of Otataral thrust deep into the ground at its very center. He feared that it would not be enough. They had all feared as much, those among them who understood what she was attempting here. The chains that bound the crippled god had been forged by gods. A single sword to shatter them all? Tavare, you must have believed it was possible. Or that some other force would awaken here to lend us a blessed hand in this? Without this, this breaking of chains, all that we do here is for naught. Tavare, I am trusting you. With the lives of my soldiers, with the meaning to their deaths, I know it's unfair asking this of you. You're mortal, that and nothing more. But I know, I feel it. I am setting my weight upon your shoulders. We all are, whether we care to admit it or not. And it's that unfairness that's tearing me apart. He glanced off to his left. Hedge walked there at the head of his own troop, Lethary and Kundril cast-offs, a mix of half-bloods from a dozen subdued tribes of the Lether Empire. They'd had trouble keeping up, so loaded down were the soldiers,